Dr. Prey's next move. Rafe needed to get inside the head of whoever had taken her. The tracks were only a few hours old, but Rafe didn't have any leads as to where they might be headed. He was in an unfamiliar land, didn't speak the language, and had no local network on which to rely. Rafe walked back inside the farmhouse, and this time his eyes were up, looking for anything he'd missed on his first pass. He didn't have to look far. A piece of paper was on the small kitchen table, torn from a notebook. On it was written a URL of seemingly nonsensical letters, numbers, and symbols, followed by two additional sets of similarly random alphanumeric combinations without the URL designation. A username and password. The dark web. Feeling a vibration, Rafe reached in his pocket and answered the phone.
"Tell me," he said. "It's not good. Did you find Hannah?" "I'm at her place now. She's been taken."
Rafe heard his friend pause on the other end of the line.
"I know who did it and where she is," Reese said.
When Reese was finished relaying the information he'd learned from the interrogation of Dmitry Mashkov, Rafe's eyes moved back to the paper in his hand.
"He's hunting her," he said. "Or he's using her as bait. Come back and I'll talk to Vic about mounting an operation to get her out. There's no time for that. He wants me or he wants you, probably both. See what you can do about it through official channels. In the meantime, I'm going to book a hunt."
Chapter 54. Medny Island, Russia. Alexander sat at his desk in his fortress on Medny. The island was first sighted in 1741 by Vitus Jonassen Bering, a Danish cartographer employed by the Russian Navy. It wasn't until a few years later that Emelyan Basov explored and hunted the island, bringing back a host of valuable furs to Kamchatka and on to trading posts throughout Russia. Alexander looked at a seal pelt on the wall.
"Fitting," he thought.
Native Aleuts had moved to the island in the late 1800s and set up a whaling station. Relying on harpoons, they hunted whales and seals until the government moved the settlement to neighboring Bering Island. It was a frontier post with Cold War military significance up until 2001, when it was abandoned. The Zharkov family dacha on the Black Sea would not do for what Alexander had in mind, so, when the opportunity presented itself, the entrepreneurial young intelligence officer had leased the island from the government. He needed a remote outpost to partake in his most dangerous of games. Siberia was remote. An island in the Bering Sea was even more so. Hunting the woman from Montana had ended in a most unsatisfying manner. He hadn't been able to feel the pleasure of releasing his arrow into his quarry. She'd also managed to kill two of his best dogs. No matter. Sergei had others to take their place. Luckily for him, a plane was about to land at a remote strip in Kamchatka. There, six new prisoners from the Central African Republic would be transferred to an MI-8 transport helicopter for the flight to Medny Island. They would provide ample opportunity to sharpen his skills before the ultimate chess match.
Americans were so easy to manipulate.
Hannah Hastings had served her purpose. Alexander had received word that an American had arrived in Romania and traveled to her farmhouse. It wouldn't be long before he put the pieces together and connected via the dark web using the note left on his sister's table. The trap was baited. Now it was time to wait. His prey would come, and Alexander would finally put himself to the test against the most worthy of adversaries. He felt like more tea.
"Sergei!" he called out.
Where was that mongrel half-breed? Probably out training the dogs or practicing with that old bow of his. Sergei and all those who carried the blood of his people remained stuck in the past. aboriginals fretting out a meager existence much as they had for centuries. They had not adapted to the changing environment. They had even attempted to defend themselves against Russian colonization with bows and spears. The result had been catastrophic. Where disease and war failed, alcoholism and forced migration picked up the slack. Sergei, whose Koryak blood had been diluted through breeding and the ravages of a war the world knew little about, still favored the ancient bow of his people over the modern crossbow that Alexander carried on their hunts. Alexander scoffed at the thought. The Siberian native had been conscripted into the Russian army. There, he'd excelled in the ranks of the Spetsnaz, serving with distinction in the Second Chechen War, putting down the insurgency using the tactics and techniques that had earned them the respect of the Mujahideen in the Soviet-Afghan campaign. Sergei's unit had been responsible for the targeted assassinations of Chechen separatist leadership by any means necessary. In the Russian army, he'd learned an appreciation for the Russian martial art of Sambo, to which he continued to devote himself with zeal. Alexander couldn't fathom why the huge Koryak dedicated so much time to unarmed combat. After all, his size seemed sufficient to deal with anyone reckless enough to fight him hand to hand. It seemed to be the one vestige of his time spent with the Spetsnaz that he carried forward into his work for Alexander. He'd spent months building a baidarka, a kayak made of driftwood, with a deck covered in seal and sea lion skins. The fool even hunted from it, in the tradition of his people. He knew the dogs, though, and, much like the canines whose company he kept, he was loyal to the man who fed him. For that, Alexander would allow him his little bow and kayak. A light on a computer used for only one purpose roused him from his musings. Alexander hovered over a Tor network icon and depressed his keypad before entering a 28-character password and entering the world of the dark web. The platforms that hosted illicit activity on the dark web changed as international consortiums of law enforcement built cases on a virtual battlefield. Silk Road, Alpha Bay and Hansa were but a few of the cyber auction houses whose specialties catered to the dark side of man. Weapons, child pornography, human trafficking, and illicit drugs were the mainstays of the realm, traded for with Bitcoin cryptocurrency, moving people and destroying lives at 50 megabits a second. The dark web was where Alexander offered a specific service to a discerning and niche customer. It was where Alexander offered the hunt of a lifetime. To those who had adorned their walls with most every species the planet had to offer, a few longed for one more trophy, one they wouldn't be able to brag about at cocktail parties in polite society. They yearned to experience the hunting of man. Marketed via the dark web, the prey were described as prisoners destined for execution. These hunters would be fulfilling a civic duty. For $500,000 US in Bitcoin, rich Russians, Europeans, and Americans had traveled to Medny for the experience that had thus far eluded them in life. Alexander ran his tongue along his bottom lip as he read the email.
"It is so nice to make your acquaintance, Mr. Rainsford."
Part 3. The Kill. I am still a beast at bay. Sanger Rainsford, The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell. Chapter 55. Boundary County, Idaho, United States-Canadian border. Reese would have preferred to somehow bring Dimitri's body back to the Hastings' property and leave it where a bear could dispose of it. Dmitri dying in the firefight at the ranch made a lot more sense than him sustaining life-threatening wounds there, then wandering 100 miles to a property coincidentally owned by Tim Thornton. But with law enforcement still combing the crime scenes, Reese and Liz had no choice but to dispose of the body in the deepest part of the lake. "I think the chair's a goner, buddy," Liz said as they contemplated how to clean up the cabin. "I'm afraid you're right." Donning surgical masks from the med bag and using bleach from under the sink, they cleaned off the leather chair as best they could. The tarp and towels went into a trash bag along with the coffee grinder, French press, and baking tray. Reese dismantled the chair with an axe and wrapped it in trash bags as well. When they were done sanitizing the crime scene, they loaded it all into the plane. With Thorne's G550 somewhere in Eastern Europe and wanting to get things moving as quickly as possible, Reese had Liz drop him in Billings. Liz borrowed a van from the corporate jet center and took her trash to a landfill. Reese was able to catch a commercial Delta flight to Minneapolis that connected into Washington Reagan National. After spending several months of solitude in a rural and isolated environment, it took Reese some time to adjust to the sights and sounds of the modern world. His mind had adapted to the natural order of the wilderness and rebelled against his re-entry into society. By 10 o'clock p.m., he was relieved to be stepping through the doorway of Katie's condo in Old Town Alexandria. "I told you it wouldn't be long," he said. Katie had beaten him to Virginia by 30 minutes, and despite the late hour, she made coffee, while Reese caught her up on the developments of the past 48 hours. "How are you feeling?" Reese asked. "Like I'm grateful that I wasn't kidnapped by a psycho assassin who likes to wrap women's heads in debt cord. Thank goodness for small favors." "I'm okay, Reese. I just keep thinking about how lucky we were that Caroline Hastings is such a great shot, and that you showed up when you did, and..."
"And what?"
"I'd be lying if I said I didn't wonder if life with you is always going to be this way."
Reese nodded. "I've wondered the same thing myself."
"Before we delve into that, though, I have an important question to ask. Do you have any honey?"
"Ha! Oh, yeah. I forgot you take your coffee like most of my old sorority sisters."
Returning to the table with honey in a small carton of half and half, she watched as Reese doctored his brew.
"I have something to tell you, Katie, and I need your help to think it through."
"What is it?"
"Rafe's little sister, Hannah, is missing. She was working in Romania, and not long after we were attacked, someone took her."
"What?"
Katie whispered in disbelief.
"The same people who are after you?"
Forcing the rational side of her brain to restrain her emotions, she closed her eyes and processed the news.
"How can I help?"
"Well, hold on," Katie interrupted. She picked up her iPad and phone, depositing them in her bedroom before closing the door. She then unplugged the LCD television hanging on the wall of her living room. Satisfied, she picked up a legal pad and sat back down.
"You're as paranoid as I am."
"It's not paranoia if someone's really after you," she said.
"I've heard that somewhere before," Reese thought. "Here's what we know. Oliver Gray was a CIA analyst who went off the grid several months ago. It turns out he was working for Vasily Andrenov, a former colonel in the GRU. He recruited Gray near the end of the Cold War and kept him on retainer even after the fall of the Soviet Union and Andrenov's ouster from the new Russian government."
"He's the Russian billionaire who was blown up in Switzerland last year?"
"That's him. Gray helped plan the operation that killed the Russian president and attempted to kill ours. After the follow-on chemical attack in Odessa, he went underground and ended up in Argentina."
"I thought they only hid Nazis."
"They're branching out. Anyway, after that, he makes his way to St. Petersburg, Russia, and started working for someone named Ivan Zharkov, who runs one of the big crime families in the Bratva, the Russian mafia."
"Why would Gray want to kill you? Why wouldn't he just lie low in Russia?"
"I can think of a couple of reasons. First is that he knows I'm going to track him down." "He's right about that. He's one of two people left who had a hand in killing Freddy." He wanted to put me down before I got the chance. Katie frowned at the casual way Reese referred to killing like it was a normal everyday occurrence, and she had to remind herself that for him, it was.
And the second?
Reese thought of the stainless steel Submariner they used to adorn his father's wrist. He'd purchased it in a PX in Vietnam and worn it every day Reese could remember. I think Gray had my father killed, Katie. I can't prove it, but I've been doing some reading while I was in the mountains. I asked Vic for some files after the Odessa incident.
When you save the life of the president, it probably opens a few file cabinets.
It doesn't hurt. I had Vic put together a list of my father's postings at the CIA from just before 9/11 until his death. Oliver Gray was in Buenos Aires the night my father was killed.
I thought you told me he was an analyst. A desk guy.
He was. I think he used the recruitment skills that Andreyev taught him to recruit a contract agent named Jules Landry to do the actual killing.
But why, Reese? Why would a former Soviet spy want to kill your father? Because of something that happened in the Cold War? I thought a lot of the warriors on opposite sides of the Iron Curtain were actually friends now.
I wondered the same thing. It goes back farther than that. It turns out that Gray signed out a file in 1993. That file was an after-action report from a MACV-SOG operation in Vietnam that resulted in the death of a Russian advisor. Can you guess the advisor's last name?
Andreyev.
That's right. And can you guess who led the mission?
Tom Reese.
Right again. I think Andreyev recruited Gray to find out who killed his father, and then all those years later finally got his revenge.
I think we need to switch to something stronger than Black Rifle coffee. I need a drink,
Katie said, standing up to retrieve two glasses from the cabinet.
I don't have any Semper yet, but I do have a nice bottle of Sea Smoke.
That'll do.
It's a 2013-10. My dad gets a case on his birthday every year from his golfing buddy, Nick Kasulis. He and his wife Tina own a golf course out in California and get it at cost for the restaurant there. My dad always saves me a bottle,
Katie said as Reese organized his thoughts. That's nice of him.
That reminds me. There's no good time to tell you. He sent me three boxes to give to you. My parents were listed as next of kin when your mom passed away. You were presumed dead, so the nursing home shipped the last of her things to my parents. I have them in the back closet when you want them.
Thanks, Katie. I'll go through them when this is all over. Now, where were we?
You were just getting to the part where Gray almost kills us?
Right. I think Gray saw an opportunity to use both the protection and resources of the Russian mob to launch a hit on me on U.S. soil.
Why Rafe as well?
That's a question I'm going to put to Vic tomorrow.
And who tipped off the CIA about the attack in Montana?
That's where this gets a little strange. A former agency case officer who spent a lot of time in Russia got a call from a Russian intelligence official named Alexander Zharkov, warning him of the attack. He called Vic, who contacted us just in time.
Any relation to Ivan Zharkov?
It's his son.
So let me get this straight.
Katie's analytical mind was going to work.
A Russian mob boss hires a former CIA mole who then plans your murder but gets sold out by the Mafia Don's son?
As best as I can figure it.
Anywhere else but Russia, that would be crazy.
Fair point, Reese conceded.
Maybe they went after Hannah when the attack in Montana failed to draw you and Rafe out so they can try again?
It's possible.
There's something you're not telling me, isn't there?
Reese nodded. During my interrogation of the Russian who survived the attack, he told me that Alexander Zharkov imports humans to his own private hunting ground on an island off the Kamchatka Peninsula.
To do what?
Katie asked, already dreading the answer. He hunts them. Rafe is on his way there now. I'm going to see if I can talk Vic into mounting a rescue operation, but the odds of that happening are slim. What I really need from him is information.
Why, may I ask?
This is the part you might